Hi, my name is Jack White. And I feel magnanimous about being Conan O'Brien's friend.
So you, what you're saying is you are...
I don't know the definition of magnetic.
Oh. You know, it doesn't mean magnetic. It does not mean that
maybe
you
I should try
to
a different
refrigerator.
Word.
Fall is here, hear the yell. Back to school, ring the bell. Brand new shoes, walking blues. Climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Hey there, welcome to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, the podcast that gives and gives and asks for nothing in return. Matt Gourley, good to see you.
Hi.
Sonam Mousessian, how are you?
Hello.
How are your little gentlemen doing?
Very good. I'd still sing them the little gentleman song. They like it a lot.
How's that go?
My little gentleman. It's when I wipe their mouths.
Aww.
It's the only way they'll be cool.
That's a song?
My little gentleman. My little gentleman. Ah. I dab your little face.
Okay.
My little gentleman.
And they like that.
Yeah. I think I could sing anything and they'll be like, eh.
Wow, a true mother's love for her children. Gourley, was lovely seeing your daughter the other day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I want to get the word out that we recorded some summer s'mores and we were over at your house.
Yeah.
And I got to meet your daughter, which was really nice.
You talking about Bill Squishman?
What?
That's her nickname.
What?
Her full nickname is Bill Squishman, founder Squishman Enterprises, co-founder Siegel Squishman Dynamics, quality through cuteness.
How cute.
What?
That's so sweet.
Why Bill Squishman? What kind of name is that for a
take
girl?
Take a look at her. She just looks like a 50s businessman.
Your daughter does kind of look like a Eisenhower era ad exec.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm lost on my own podcast. I don't know what we're talking about now.
Well, just, our families.
Our families.
Oh.
Yeah. You had nicknames for Nev and Beckett, I'm sure, that were weird and interesting.
Child one, child two.
No, you come into a room and you call people Chopper and stuff like that.
Oh, I love that.
So why can't you wrap your head around this?
No, Bill, it just threw me a little bit.
Okay.
That you switch genders, you know, but I shouldn't because I know that everyone's gender fluid.
Modern times.
So yeah. Your daughter is Bill Squishman, head of Squishman Enterprises.
Founder. Yeah.
Okay.
And head of.
Yeah.
Title on the business card.
Nice. Yeah. What a lovely story you'll have for her one day. What did you call me, Papa? Little Snookums, Snackums? We called you Bill Squishman, founder of Squishman Enterprises. How do you feel in your new role as father? Do you think you're a good dad or are you an awful
father? I don't know if
father?
I'm a good dad, but I have never been happier in my life. I'm crazy about this. It is insane. I love it so much.
It took me years to start to understand this whole affection for children thing.
Oh.
My kids. Liza kept saying, get in there and try one more time. Just spend more time with them. I'm like, I don't know.
What does this
have to do with my career?
Oh, yeah.
I don't see how this helps me.
I look at her and go, you can take me away from my career. I love you so much.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
You say that, but you don't mean it. Once you're around them for a while, like more than an hour, that's when you want out.
I don't know.
You're a cold, withered, dead tree on a hilltop, you know? You've got no emotion, man. You need to warm up.
Okay. You know? All right. That's good advice.
Yeah.
That's good advice. I'm going to do that. I'm going to change completely. Okay. It's a joke. I love my children.
I've seen you interact with your kids and you're very loving, tender father.
I fight my son a lot.
You guys do wrestle.
I wrestle everybody. I love physical confrontation. And I think it's a good way to get closer to people is to fight them.
You've never fought me.
No, I haven't. I'm worried about you. One good punch from me and you might just fall apart.
Oh, really?
Well, it's true. You know, look at me. I'm a big masculine man.
I was going to say, I never side with him, but you do seem a little, not brittle. What's the word I'm looking for? Fragile?
Excuse me?
You do. I mean, to be fair, you look like you're made of marzipan and you're a delicious treat for the holidays, but...
Excuse me?
But I do think that...
I was in the theater department.
I'm sure you were.
Okay.
I'm sure you were.
All right. I have a master's degree in theater, so... Let's have some respect here.
I think, like in a cartoon, if I punched you really hard, you'd explode into a bunch of pieces and then they would all fall down and you'd be this nice arrangement of Hummel figurines that would fall down and assemble themselves.
You think I'm fragile?
You're very fragile.
I still own all my Legos, okay?
No, but you know what I mean. He is. I'm a guy who can take a punch and give a punch.
No.
I'm a man's man through and through. I have an anchor tattoo on my bicep.
Do you arm wrestle? Is that what this is? Are you?
Arm wrestle doesn't prove anything. I'm just saying.
Oh, if nice dodge.
Matt.
Nice dodge.
If I needed to, I could claw through your chest to get through you instantly.
But I might,
it would be very
I might
soft.
Just like right when you do that, I'll bust into a Shakespeare monologue. What are you going to do then? I don't know.
Weirdo.
So I would love to, the two of you fighting, the picture I have in my head is just this.
Well, it's very quick.
It's very quick. I've ever seen.
It's a slap fight. I think slap fighting
lots
is
of, like, kicks a lot from of this. Far away. And
I slap, kick, and bite if I have to, but I get the job done. Really? That's my motto. Well,
I'm sorry I called you fragile, but I mean, that means that you're not like a fighter.
Yeah.
No, I'm not a fighter.
That's a compliment.
I'm
glad to do this podcast. We found someone to sit across from me who makes me feel like a tough guy.
Oh,
that's
man.
What we essentially, no, that's what we essentially did. I feel like Ernest Borgnine over here. I feel like a big bruiser.
Let me just take a drink.
Slurp.
I don't know. Is that is that healthy?
Sweet chamomile.
Yawn.
Sleepy time.
No.
All right. Well, should we get into the show?
Yeah.
Please.
You better before I get angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
No.
Oh, man. It's not working.
It's called cranky.
You know, wouldn't fussy. Like me when I'm...
You wouldn't like me. You wouldn't like me when I get fussy. It's not the same. It's not the same.
You wouldn't like me when I'm teething.
Yeah. My guest today, so thrilled he's here, is a Grammy award-winning singer-songwriter who released his fourth studio album, Fear of the Dawn, earlier this year. Now has a new album, so prolific, Entering Heaven Alive, out July 22nd. He's currently on a world tour with tickets available on his website. Absolutely thrilled he's with us today. My friend Jack White is here. Welcome. So glad that you're here with us today. You and I have been friends for a long time.
That is correct.
Most of the people that I talk to on this podcast are not my friends.
They're not your friends, or they're pretending to be your friend. Mm.
Many people in this town.
To make it in the business, to progress to the next level.
No one climbs the showbiz ladder until they've made friends with one
they've
Conan O'Brien.
Bread with Conan. Yeah.
Yeah, and but you and I have known each other for a really long time.
Many, many years.
Many people say your whole musical style was sort of based on. What am I doing here?
No, can we stop you before you keep going?
Just lying.
Yeah, just lying.
Just making shit up.
Flat out lying.
That's
you
wrong.
Used to, as a child, watch me on Late Night, and then you said I could maybe use his vocal rhythms.
No, none never. Of that.
In guitar solos.
An example of what not to do.
Yeah. Okay. Nothing. All right. Well, no. Maybe I went too far, and I do apologize. No, you are. With so many people like Sona, you only think I'm cool because I know.
That's
Jack.
Actually
that's
very
the only
true.
Reason you think I'm cool.
Yeah. You. I mean, think about your other friends. Well, I love them, but you know they're not Jack White.
It's Dork Central. Yeah. And then there's you.
This guy wrote a James Bond theme song.
I know.
And you know him.
I know. And you are, of course, the James Bond aficionado of all time.
And of that movie.
Oh,
yeah.
That's one of the most divisive things I've been a part of was that song.
Why is that?
I mean, it's to this day, it's straight across the board. People always say, oh, you're a lover, you hate it, something. That song is, there are people who hate it so much and people who love it so much. Yeah. Nowhere in the middle. It's so strange.
That's like the movie itself.
I think. So the movie comes along with what people think of it, but Bond themes in Britain, for example, are like, that's consistent coffee breakfast conversation. Oh. You know, like, what's your favorite Bond song? It's almost like who you are as a person. Like, you relate to which song means something to you. Whatever.
It's really, I mean, it's great company to be in, though, when you think about some of the iconic Bond songs.
Oh, yeah. Even if
what's your favorite Bond song of all time?
There's the one that I think I'm drawn to is Tom Jones's Thunderball. And I don't know if you know this, but Johnny Cash recorded an attempt at Thunderball.
This is crazy.
Yes, this I heard
just
this.
Came up on the Jeff Goldblum episode. He was saying how much he loved Thunderball, and I was talking about this Johnny Cash.
Of course.
Oh, dear boy. Oh, yes. Oh, well.
Yeah, it was while he was feeling all of our faces with his tentacles.
Oh, yes, Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash wanted to have recorded a Bond song. Yes. It just didn't make it.
It didn't make it, yeah.
Unsolicited submission.
I got in because Amy Winehouse wasn't showing up to the sessions, wasn't delivering the song that they were asking her to do. So it was, we're running out of time. We need somebody else to do it. And I thought, oh, this is great because now I'm going to get away with murder. I'm going to put things in this song. They would never approve of this,
right.
This section and all that. And that happened. It got to be, the music director was not down with it. And he was trying to kind of convince me to turn it into a ballad or something like that. And it got interesting. It was like, we're going on tour. I don't have time. I really can't get in there. Knowing full well, I totally have time to fix it if I want.
It's so funny when my favorite move is, I'm sorry, I can't, but I don't have time. And then that person sees you at a leisurely lunch 2 hours later, and you're clearly doing nothing.
Just joking.
One of my favorite moves, and you know who did it to me once? Adam West.
Really?
Adam West, when Robert Smigel and I were working on this TV project, we wanted to bring Adam West back to TV, and we were working on this kooky project called Look Well, and we had this audition with him with the network, and they said, yes, we're going to bring Adam West back to TV. You guys can make this pilot. We were so excited. And we said to him, hey, do you want to go out and get dinner with anyone? I'd love to, gentlemen, but I'm very busy. I have big plans tonight. And we were like, oh, okay, Mr. West, no problem. And then Robert and I went down to the hotel to get dinner. And we saw him sitting alone.
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 He'd rather be alone.
That man would rather sit alone. And he saw us and gave like a little nod. He wasn't even ashamed. You didn't think I'd really have dinner with you, did you? Not at all, Mr. Wayne. We understand.
Oh, my God.
You know, first of all, I want to congratulate you on Fear of the Dawn, which I've been listening to.
Oh, thanks.
Love it. And I had a lot of questions. First of all, the sound. It's a different sound than I've heard you get before. I'm fascinated by this because I know I'm going to go see you perform tomorrow night. And I'm curious, is it important to you to try and recreate that sound when you perform live? Or does that not really matter to you?
I sort of try to keep a little like loose structure of what that is,
right,
with the idea of opening it up and making it into something maybe not bigger or better, but at least different or interesting for a second, another little path. But that can be hard to do. Some songs you have to play it that way. That's just kind of how it's going to go. There's not much you can do to change it. Other things, if you change them, they become better and better, and people kind of wish that what you're doing live was the one that was on the album, you know.
Yep.
You try to find that that medium in the middle. But what's interesting is, yeah, like going on tour right now, we're on our maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks into touring, I guess, worth of shows. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's like the 20th or show or something by now. But they're so different than they were the first couple of shows, these songs. And there's times where it's getting better, and sometimes it's getting not as good as it was when we first started. So you're constantly reeling it in and casting.
It's fascinating to me because you're two things. You're a studio creature. You love being in the studio, and you love the machinery.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've seen you, maybe the coolest thing I've ever done in my life was when we were on tour. You remember this summer?
I remember it,
And you invited me over to your house.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mode of getting around was on a tour bus.
Yeah.
So a giant tour bus pulled up in front of your very cool house in Nashville, and I stepped off the bus and it went like,
and
the doors opened, and I stepped out and I walked up this long driveway to your house, and then you took me into the recording studio, and
I had you take all your clothes off.
Yes, which then, you said was for audio.
Oh yeah,
no, and I'm standard, like,
whatever you say, Mr. White. How does this affect audio?
I don't know why I was talking that way, but it happens whenever I'm in Nashville. But I could tell you're just really into the gadgetry and the machinery of it and getting your hands on tape.
Yeah.
I know you edit like with a razor blade. You really like to get in there and make stuff. But then I've seen you perform, when you're performing live, that's got to feel like a completely different gear. I mean, it's a completely different, you're not like encased in your bat cave and figuring this all out. You're out there.
Mm-hmm. You, are you done?
fucker. No, I'm not.
Okay, go ahead. It's your show. The cup says your name on it.
It does. And I guess my point is that there's a duality to all of us. Sort of a double nature,
is this
if you
where
will.
You guys showed me interrupt, right? Yeah. You told me earlier.
I slip you a note. Go.
This is where you interrupt.
And also save us.
Every man is a yin-yang, if you will.
No.
Please continue.
But when you came in, this is a great example of exactly what you're talking about, is when you came in to record, I don't know if you guys know this, maybe you do, but we were doing sort of a spoken word record. We were trying to do a recording, and he came in, he was just checking the mic, and we were just setting the level of the compressor and all that. And his checking the mic became the record. He made up this whole story about Frankenstein off the top of his head. And it was so good. Uh-huh. And it's the kind of thing where I always imagine when I was younger, I bet stuff like that happens, and they don't put it in TV shows, and they don't put it on that. And that's the good stuff. That's the stuff they should put on there. And of course, that was the A side of the single, was what you just did testing the mic, and that's how talented you are, and how you're able to ad lib and make something interesting immediately. I thought that when I first did Saturday Night Live, they did, you know, that how they do a 2-hour version and they cut out 30 minutes of sketches.
Yes, they do dress and then they do air, yeah.
And then several of the sketches don't make the final cut. And there was one that was like, so great. Oh, man, that was so fun. I can't believe that didn't make it. And the next time I did Saturday Night Live, the same thing happened. And I was like, I got to talk to Lauren once and said, you know, it would be great if you just hired a couple guys just to go through the 40 plus years of and find all those sketches.
Great sketches.
And make together like some DVD, like box set of lost stuff. Oh, I don't think people would be interested in that. No, just kidding.
I could see him not wanting to do that because
he didn't get. He was negative about it. He was just like, yeah. But I mean, actually, recently we've seen more like cut for time things they post. And
you know what happened, and it's this new world we live in. But Lorne Michaels, when you think about it, Saturday Night Live starts. He's 30 years old, and it's 1975. And
yeah.
So the whole idea of lost tapes, or let's get stuff out of the archive that's somewhat funky or didn't have a lot of mass appeal, felt, well, that's completely antithetical to what show business was
right,
at the time.
Yeah.
When late night television started, it was essentially found space. It was the equivalent of someone finding an attic that they didn't know about.
Yeah, yeah.
And so networks realized, wait a minute, we've got this time from 11, and it used to be the Tonight Show, I think, it was like 2.5 hours every night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you look at those early ones, and it is
2.5
guys smoking cigarettes and killing time.
Killing time. Yeah.
And so there was that affected what the vibe was and what the content was, because you had, you know, if you had, and I think in a weird way, we've almost gone full circle because that's
podcast,
what this feels like.
Yeah. It feels like if you had told me, you know, whatever, 15 years ago, would be headed to an area where people would find podcasts interesting and listen to them. And I would have said, oh, no, it's going to be way too much, you know, it's not millisecond changeovers and flash editing and blah, 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 and hitting you over the head. That's what we'd always expect that the future has got in store for us, is watching 8 channels at the same time or something like that. And you're it's a lot of ways people have done the opposite of what you thought were going to happen, like this being a great example of it.
This format's been around for a long time, but it's kind of magical at this stage to get to freeform like this.
Yeah. The need for content almost, but from the whole world or entertainment or the internet, has almost made things, real things, become popular or interesting again, where people are actually working with their hands on YouTube rather than just showing some nonsense or something. It's, oh, this guy can actually build something, or this guy can actually knows what he's talking about. Because I was complaining years ago, I think it's, I don't know how many years ago, but I started sort of feeling like there's this death of the expert vibe was happening, where it was, say, if you're a musician, someone came in and reviewed your record, you kind of had at least a thought, well, that guy probably got hired by such and such magazine because he's got 5,000 records in his collection.
Right.
He's been to, 10,000 live shows. And it seemed like all of a sudden now it was some kid who was 19 who hadn't seen a live show. 3 years ago was the first time he went and saw a concert. And you're kind of like, where's the experts at? Are they kind of going away because of the death of print journalism or something like that? But I think it's kind of turned around in a different way. Now you're seeing more actual experts getting the mic or getting on camera that know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, I'm sure there's a million people trying to become famous or whatever, but they're... It's interesting to know that format has now lent itself to people are now, being able to experience that.
There used to be gatekeepers in show business.
Yeah, yeah.
And show business was a very small club.
Right.
And if you think about the 40s, the 1950s,
yeah, there like really 10 were 10 actors.
Yeah, it was just like 10 actors yeah. and 10 actresses. Mm. And if you were in the club, you were in the club for life. And we talk about this all the time, but I don't know who most people are anymore. Yeah. Mm. I don't know who, because I don't really watch a lot of like reality television or anything. So I'm constantly, and the same thing with music, where it's very hard to keep up.
Yeah.
I just went to Coachella, took my daughter to Coachella, and I was blown away, first of all, by how much talent there was there, mm-hmm. but also kind of blown away by, I should know all this, but I don't.
It's hard. It's way more than it used to be. I used to be able to open up like a Enemy magazine or something in 2001, and I knew every band, every little punk band that was in there. And after a while, it's gotten so large. There's so many TV shows. There's so many, you know, things out there. It's very hard to keep up.
Also, there's this, all the advertising, because I've talked about this, but when I like drive down Sunset Boulevard, cruising for chicks.
Of course.
When I drive down Sunset Boulevard and I see...
This was taking your daughter on the way to Coachella?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to get into context.
Can I just say something? Yeah. She understands the deal.
Oh, okay.
She understands dad's insatiable need to cruise for chicks.
And you see a wanted billboard with your face on?
Hey, that looks a lot like me. No, but you see so many ads for TV shows...
Yeah.
And all of them have reviews that say, if you're not watching Governor Potato, you're not watching television. You know, Stanley Bobo from Whip-Wap magazine. And then you see another one, and they're very...
I would watch that.
They're very judgmental. It's like, if you're not watching Colonel Squash Machine, then you suck. And 9 stars out of 5. And you just like, the demand that you have to see everything is absolutely insane. But
there was a guy, Rob Stringer from Sony, he was like the head of Sony Records, and he told me, you know, it's funny, Jack, like back in the 70s, if you went, you could be a music fan, you could know everything.
Yeah.
You could actually know everything about music. You know, there wasn't a band or a release that you didn't have at least a slight knowledge of, okay, I know at least know that genre. I'm not interested in that opera, but I know that my uncle listens to that music, and this is rockabilly over here, and over here is some jazz, blah, blah, blah. But there wasn't stuff out there, like, and there became a certain point where there were so many people and so much content, you couldn't possibly know even 10% of what's out there. You know, like when we were, say I was a kid in the 80s, you would not see a rock and roll song on a TV commercial. Like maybe when Nike did the Beatles thing, it was like, oh my God, a rock and roll song was used on a commercial. Because they needed time for all those people who grew up with rock and roll to get older in positions of power where they were the ones deciding what was going to be in the ad and what was going to be that. And now that's gone even another, obviously a generation or two deeper. It's almost, what I keep seeing is like a commercial where they're doing like the fake, try peppermint gum. It's the blah, blah, blah. Like, what are you spoofing? That doesn't even exist anymore. Like, there is no fake thing happening. It's all like 90% of commercials are comedic or ironic. There is no actual thing to be spoofing anymore. You understand the points I'm trying to make in that entire monologue? Just pick one of them and we can talk about it.
Are you done?
The thing I love about microphones is when you get them right in your mouth, they get louder.
I don't have a lot of regrets in life, but there's a saying, no regrets, and I've never understood it, because I do have regrets. And one is, when we were doing our show at TBS, you contacted me. I had no idea you were serious. You said, I'd like to do the upholstery. I'd like to make you your talk show couch. And I was like, that's so hilarious, man. That's great. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you were like, no, I was serious. I would have made I felt like such a lost opportunity to have a talk show where Jack White made my talk show couch.
I'm looking at 4 upholstered chairs right now. It's not too late.
That's true. Yeah, we should put you to work. But you were
just fabric, no welting on the edges.
It's all right. This guy, first of all, you did an apprenticeship for how many years as an upholsterer?
Many, many, many years. Yeah, I started when I was 15, and I had my own shop when I was 21. Then that's when the real learning begins, is when you open your own place, you know, because you're like, have nobody to ask advice about anymore.
So you opened your own shop.
Yeah.
Did it do well?
It did okay, yeah. But it did only sort of, I was so strange with it that it was, you know, I was doing sculpture as well. So people were kind of, you know, I started, everything became an art form with me. I was filling the, you know, the insides of the furniture with poetry and oh, you know, the bills I was writing in crayon, like it would be yellow paper with black crayon, like, you owe me $300. And I would present it to them and I delivered a piece in the yellow and black uniform with a yellow van that was the old Detroit Fire Department van. And it was, people were like, what? You know, and it's like not, you know, people, we probably would have got return customers for some of these people, but yeah, no return customers. But they would pass my name on. It seemed funny because it always got just enough money from it to pay the bills. It was never any more than that. It was always broke even or less.
Are there people out there right now that have a couch that you've put poetry in and they don't know it?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Certainly.
Oh, right now, people are listening to this just ripping their couches. Yeah. Have you ever made like a leather quilted door? You know those? Like,
Yeah. I've done those, really? Yeah. Button tufting, it's called, yeah. And
button tufting asshole.
No, this is the first time
you
I
cut
agree
me off
you,
before I could say it.
I'm an asshole for not saying that. I'm sorry.
I mean, so you did that for a while, and you're obviously pursuing music at the same time.
And that was kind of tough because I had a studio, so I was doing sculpture in there, like constructed sculpture and sort of carpentry based stuff and garbage picking and putting that together in sort of hardware store art. I was thinking of it being sort of hardware store art and working on furniture there to pay the bills. And then also sometimes I would bring a guitar in there too, but that usually was a mistake because I would quit working on the furniture and go and play guitar and realize, oh my God, I've been playing for 2 hours sitting here. I should get back to work. And eventually that got to the point where the White Stripes got enough offers to go and play shows that I was taken away from the furniture enough that actually we started making enough money playing shows, which was shocking to us, you know.
Yeah.
That was yeah. So then I eventually closed the shop up, but I kept everything and I rebuilt it in Nashville behind my house. So I still have it now.
Do you still do it sometimes? Do you still do some upholstery to just kill time?
Oh yeah. Or? I did a lot of projects during the pandemic. Actually 2020, the first year of the pandemic, I worked on nothing but furniture really. And
let me rephrase my question. Yeah. Do you take commissions on leather button doors?
At times, yes. At times.
Okay. It's so funny because I have a very
could I ask for some more Coke Zero?
Okay, what we the fuck? Any? Okay, well, and I guess this is now a restaurant.
Yeah. Also, just the bill when you get a chance.
It's going to come in crayon.
I haven't had sugar in over 2 years. I haven't had sugar since 2019 or any carbs since 2019.
Really?
Yeah.
What brought that on?
I had no clue about the pandemic about to happen, but I thought that I thought it would be nice to start the... is that Bud Light? Bud Zero?
So you decided you just went completely off sugar and you've stuck with it?
Still, yeah. It's been since 2019. I haven't had any sugar or carbs, really.
Because you've been insufferable since you showed up.
That's the thing. I think people are starting to say, throwing candy bars at me.
You walked in, you're like, hey, asshole.
You used to be nice.
Yeah. You must have moments where you've taken this... crazy journey.
Too seriously?
Exactly. No, but I mean, I went to you and I went to a Dodgers game together and we're sitting in Dodger Stadium.
Next to Kendrick Lamar, by the way.
Yeah, next to Kendrick Lamar. I remember that. Next to him. And then they start, and Bob Newhart was there. It was a kooky
gathering. It's one of those nights where you're with Conan, Kendrick, and Newhart, and you're just asking yourself.
No, it was the craziest group. And so anyway, we're there.
Wait,
and
are all four of you literally together?
No. I went with Jack. We went and it was such a cool night for me because we drove over and on the way over, you were like, oh, I'll play you some new music I've been working on in the car. And first of all, rock and roll always beats comedy. Comedians don't get to do that. I can't say like, oh, I did an interview. Hold on a second. With David Spade. And I want to play you a couple of tracks from it. You know, let's really boost the bass on David Spade's voice. You know, it doesn't work that way. So, but you get to play this amazing music. And I'm like, shit, it is better to be a rock star.
I don't know.
So anyway, we get to Dodger Stadium. We hook up with our posse, Kendrick Lamar, Bob Newhart. And
oh my God.
But I remember sitting with you at Dodger Stadium, and they start to go, doom, 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 doom. And you're just sitting there, and I'm like, this has become an anthem that is ubiquitous in across the globe. Mm. Everyone knows how it goes. And it's one of the most famous, you know, licks, riffs, tunes ever. And I was just sitting with you going like, oh, right, this is you. You know? I think I started to make up lyrics about money's coming in your pocket. And you're like, I am making some money. But it reminded me like how fucking freaky that must be.
It's strange, yeah. My mother was a huge fan of the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, me too. I love that movie.
I still love it to this day. And so he's obviously playing the character George M. Cohan, and who had written the big World War One song over there.
Yeah.
And at the last scene in the movie, I think he walks out of the White House, and there's a parade of soldiers singing over there, and he's walking with them. Yeah. And we've got a soldier next to him. James Cagney says, "What's the matter, old timer? You don't know this song?"
Yeah.
And he wrote it. And I think of that every time I hear that Seven Nation Army on a sports broadcast or something on TV. It has the same feeling that it's not mine anymore. I mean, it becomes folk music when things like that happen. It becomes something that the more people don't know where it came from, the happier I am. You know, the more it just becomes ubiquitous. I'm sure many people are chanting the melody, have no idea what the song is or where it came from or why or whatever. It doesn't matter anymore. And that's just amazing.
Right. And it's funny because over time you will even lose your connection to where you were sitting when you came up with that.
Oh, it's strange.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Or you guys probably banged that out and said
so quickly. We filmed it. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Let's go get a donut now. Yeah. And that's the level of intensity, you know.
We filmed that recording of that record a bunch, and I know that song was just filmed for a minute because it was not considered anything interesting at that moment. It was just other things we were working on we thought were way more interesting. And so yeah, you'll see that we saw the video too. It's like we should have filmed a little bit more of this song being recorded than we did. No one ever knows. The labels didn't want to release it as a single when we were coming out with the album. They had picked a different song. So you just goes to show you, even when you've got it right in front of your face, sometimes you still don't know, because it's not about really. You can market something, or you can brand something, or you can push it, or you can try to support it and build it into something bigger. But you really have no idea what's going to connect with other people.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Satisfaction famously was like a B-side. Oh. They were like, well, this will be some filler.
Oh, you're right.
They didn't, even listening to it in the playback, they didn't know. Wow. Mm. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
I was going to ask you today, I just came across the word pandering this morning. I was reading something, and I kind of define it in my mind. What do you think pandering is in show business? What would you like? Can you give me some examples of what you think pandering is?
Okay, I didn't realize this was going to turn into a quiz, but all right, I'll go along with this. I think to pander to someone is it's almost like you're abandoning your belief system, and you're just like, if I were to pander to Matt Gourley,
no,
this isn't a bad thing, but I would. To pander to you means that I would subsume, let go of my own personality and just say like, aren't Bond movies great? Or just talk to you about things that you like and almost act as if I'm exactly on the same wavelength as you, even though I don't completely agree. Is that?
I think you're looking at it a little more negatively than I would.
I think pander is a negative word. You pander to the audience.
I would think it's a negative word, but maybe.
I don't know.
Do you have a positive take on it?
I do. Like when you go, when you were on tour in 2010 and you would take specific things about those cities, you were in a way, weren't you kind of pandering to them?
Yeah. I'm a terrible panderer.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying
I still think it's negative.
I don't know. I don't think you gave anything of yourself up. I think
it's a terrible quality.
We can hate what we do.
Yeah.
That's not the question. No, I'm just kidding.
I think you're adapting to your surroundings, and you don't necessarily have to give up who you are for it. I think you're just adapting.
It has a negative, I do think it has a mostly negative connotation.
Okay. Is there a form of selling out involved in it too?
I think a little bit. Like, if you
pander to the crowd and only played the songs of yours that they are most familiar with. And it, there's something about not challenging people. You're not because, challenging because people when you pander to them.
What you think they want as opposed to what you feel like you should be doing creatively.
If you, on stage, on tour, for example, you know, show business rules sort of dictate if you don't pander a little bit, if I don't say, hello, Columbus, Ohio, how are you guys doing tonight? If you don't say the name of the town, even say hello. I mean, there are times where I get out and play, I want to play five songs without even talking on the mic, without even saying, I don't even want to hear my own speaking voice. I just want to perform and get into that zone. And I realize about two songs in, I really shouldn't do that. I should stop and say, hello, Cleveland, how you guys doing? Okay, great. And, you know, but right. And in my mind, every time I feel like that's not me. That's not who I really am. It's not what I want to do right now.
Right.
And I would love to tell the story of being like completely, I never pandered to anybody or I never gave up my artistic whatever I want to do at that moment. But I don't know. You can't really do that. You have to play a little bit along with the scenario you're in. You have to play the room that you're in a little bit. And then I think that may be impossible to not pander.
You know, I always love when you just said right now, hello, Cleveland, and the guy in the crowd who's like, I flew in from Akron, you know. Yeah. I've always been.
And Akron.
Yeah. I drove from Buffalo. You know, like people that just, there's people in the crowd who would take you, just be like, no, I've got to make it clear to him that I am not.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always loved the concept of a very articulate, specific heckler.
Yes.
And we're from the excerpt. We're from the suburbs.
Went to a magic show one time where the magician's trick was to, he could tell anybody in the crowd would stand up and say their zip code, because he used to work at the post office when he was younger. Mm-hmm. Anyone who'd walk up and stand up and say their zip code, I'll tell you exactly where you're from. And me and my friends thought of so many jokes that wanted to play on this guy. I mean, we didn't do any of them. Mine was like, I knew that 48222 was the zip code of the mail boat on the Detroit River that has its own zip code that delivers mail. I was going to say I was from there.
Bastard.
I didn't mess with
it. You strike me as the kind of kid that would go to like a Sturbridge Village where they've recreated. You know when the actors there who recreate, so go in and there's a guy from the smithy shop and he's right. there and he's like, well, hello. And what you always want to do is go, hey, what do you think this is? And you hold up a digital watch. I was the guy that wanted to do that. And they always have to do the same thing. You can tell the actors are always like, what devilry is this? Yon device on wrist. Why, you must be in league with Satan. And they're just like, fucking go away, kid.
Sixth one today.
Yeah. You're not the first to do that. Yeah.
No.
Love it when people play along, though. You know they're good people, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
We were at a hotel the other day on tour, and this hotel, as you're walking out, it had some kind of old ticket booth as you were leaving. So the exit, it was like, I guess maybe for a valet or something, but it was a ticket booth, a glass window. And we were leaving, a couple of us, and there was a guy sitting in there, and we're walking outside, and I turned to him and said, two tickets to life, please. And he leaned in.
That'll be $750.
It's like, you're a good guy. You're a good guy.
I think about you at times, and then I call you, and it gets weird. But
it's usually 3 a.m. in the morning. Oh, you're usually drunk.
I love you.
That would be a blessing if you said that. I know. I think about you.
I fucking hate you. I want you to know that.
I will kill you, and I will never be linked to the murder. And then you're like, Conan, these calls are all recorded. Damn it! No, I've thought about how you, and I think I've been able to do it to some degree, which I'm very happy about, which is I've managed to take my own eccentricities and build a life around it, you know, but I've never seen anyone do it more successfully than you, where when you go to Third Man Records in Nashville, you have, and I remember the first time when I went there and I was walking around, looking the way everyone was dressed and all the stuff you have on the wall. And it occurred to me, you're a villain from Batman. You are a villain. Yeah, and I've talked to you about this, but like, I was like, where have I seen this before? Oh, right, the Riddler. The Riddler makes everyone who works for him wear, even if they're like out of shape guys in their 40s, they have to wear close-knit, form-fitting sweaters that have question marks on them. And you know that they were like, oh, fuck, it pays well, the Riddler, but we have to, and he calls us Quizzle and Quazzle and...
Quizzle.
But I was like thinking about, and then I started to imagine the FedEx guy and Amazon guy who delivered a third man coming to the door, and it's like, we've got a cuckoo clock here, but instead of a cuckoo, a Roy Orbison comes out and sings Only the Lonely, and instead of 12 numbers on it, it has 15 numbers, and it's supposed to be mounted upside down. And the idea of you at the door saying, that's, you must have the wrong address. That's not us. And in the background, they see cuckoo clocks where Roy Orbison's are coming out, and they're like, I'm pretty sure. And like, no, I don't. I think you have the wrong place.
I don't think I ordered this.
But it was so, you've made, through sheer force of will and talent and just monofocus, I think you've managed to, I mean, you did it, you know, in The White Stripes, it was all about like the aesthetic. Mm. It has to be, this is what we're about. This is what the look is. This is what the sound is. And then you just, I think, kept doubling down on that in your life in different ways. And the result is now you've built this ecosystem around you that's really very cool and creative and thank populated you. With people that have to dress the way you tell them.
Don't get any ideas.
I'm just thinking.
I think it's cool not to have to think about what you're going to wear every
well,
day.
Well, I'm glad you said that. So.
What would you put us in?
Oh, my God. You would be dressed as a little Dutch boy.
Well, I'm hearing
hey,
this.
Hold on. Hold on, guys. And please don't be mad at me. Will you please do one episode of this where they have to wear what you tell them?
Yes. Oh. Yes. Yes.
And it has to be, you can't know, you know, can I just give the parameters for it?
Yes, of course.
I think that it can't be, you can't know until you show up that day and there's no out. There's no, you can't say no
fantastic.
To it.
I love this. You know,
wait, and, what's in this for us?
Nothing really no. is
you
in
get
it.
To continue
no.
working for Team Coco. I mean, that's
or we don't to, do it, we're yeah. fired?
You mean I get to finally,
of course you are.
I get to finally quit.
You know, have you seen Jack when someone shows up, when someone's in the background moving an amp and they forgot to wear their little bowler hat? Guy totally loses it. I've seen him on stage. Like, he totally stops
flipping tables.
Where's your fucking bowler? So well, it's 110 degrees. We're playing a Bonnaroo. It's really hot. Get your fucking bowler.
What's Sona going to wear?
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. Okay. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I want it, you to be dressed as a flower pot.
Oh.
With a big flower coming out of your head.
What?
And you have to, every 30 seconds, you have to go, I'm a flower pot. If I ask you a question, before you answer the question, anything, Sona, how you doing today?
I'm a flower pot.
Pretty good. Doing pretty good. The kids are all right. I love it.
Okay.
It's the, like you know, there's that famous Twilight Zone where Billy
it's team building. It's team building. Okay.
It's team destroying.
The women this. That work for Jack wear such beautiful dresses and outfits.
Well,
and
he might choose that. He might choose that.
Jack
no,
has a very cool. Jack has a
stupid.
Cool aesthetic. I come from more of a cartoony world.
Yeah, I'm gonna come in with foam.
And I'm really big into degradation.
Yeah. You hope it's foam. It could be actual like terracotta pottery.
There's gonna be real soil involved in your costume.
I'm a flower
no,
pot.
No, but it must be. There, I mean, there have to be moments when you just when you look at the world that you've created around you and go, was this all compulsion? Was this like this couldn't have been the plan when you were 20 years old?
It was sort of like I think it came out of a couple of things, which was what I was doing on my own in my upholstery shop, like I had described, which was sort of melding art and business together. Maybe it was a way of justifying the business part of it so that it felt creative. But obviously it didn't work to a lot of people. It was very the wrong business move to make because they didn't consider me a professional or took it seriously or thought I was this was like a art piece or something rather than they actually just wanted their, you know, wingback chair reupholstery or something. So maybe there's part of that. But there's also my first band I was in was called Goober and the Peas. I was a drummer in this band. I was the 13th drummer of this band.
Jeez, wow.
So they had just gone through drummers like Spinal Tap. And this was my first tour. And they dressed like Grand Old Opry cowboys with hats. The beautiful Hank Williams. That was the whole look of the band.
Like the nudie suits kind
of
look.
Yes, like nudie suits. And I was, every drummer was named Doc. That was your name. So I came in and I said to them, you know, like, hey, I really like playing the music and all that. I don't really know about wearing this get up here. You know, like, this is not really me. I mean, I like country music, all right, but I'm not from Nashville or or wherever. I'm from Detroit, and it's kind of hard to play drums in a 10-gallon hat and all these excuses and stuff like that. And they were like, no, I'm just trying to explain to me. They showed me pictures of the Grand Opry. This is what we're trying to accomplish here. And I thought, okay, all right. And I went along. It's not my band anyway. I'm a hired gun, basically. So I did that. And then I learned that it didn't matter what kind of music you had or if it was any good or if it was better than the other bands, whatever. You knew when you went to other places, if you were on a bill or if you were on a festival, this band got noticed immediately just because they weren't wearing jeans and a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Someone said to me, like, if you go on stage in jeans and a t-shirt, all the people that are doing it are thinking that they're not wearing a uniform, mm-hmm. but they're now wearing the new uniform, which is jeans and a t-shirt. And if you're doing that, now you're making the same choice that everybody else is making. You know, 97% of the people on stage are choosing that uniform. So if you're going to make a choice, you might as well start thinking about what it is that you're trying to project and what you're trying to send, the message you're trying to send out to the world as a performer or an artist or anything like that. So that got me thinking a lot about those things as experience, and time went on. By the time Third Man Records was around, it was also making people feel included. Like, we are all part of the creativity of what's happening. If you're in the art department, or if you're a sound man, or if you're working in the store up front, that we're all kind of working in this creative team in some sense. And maybe in a way, it makes people feel like they have a reason to, that their voice is heard as much as everybody else's in some way.
Yeah. You know, it's a little evocative of like Warhol's Factory.
Sure.
That's what I was feeling when I was at, you know, Third Man, is that there's this idea that we're all going to contribute. Everyone's contributing in different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny that you bring up this idea of melding art and business, because all I ever really wanted to do is make stuff. That's what makes me happy.
I remember you telling me that, I mean, you obviously got your new environment here. This is so cool that you're able to do this, and maybe you're able to do this because you're under different constraints than you were in other things that you were doing. I remember you telling me I think it was the Tonight Show when you got there, and you just made a joke about having a marching band, and then one showed up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the budget was so much bigger to be able to just think of ideas and there, snap your finger and it's there.
And there's a upside and a downside to it. You know, I always think some of the greatest records in the world were made on 2-track or 4-track.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And then the minute you give someone 85 tracks and unlimited time, that's how you kill a great.
That can often be a bad move,
Yeah, I just think that.
But here's the example is there are different kinds of constraints. There's that you've worked under the constraint where you snap your fingers and a marching band shows up.
Yeah, yeah.
And the constraints where it's a seat of your pants, like we're all putting together a show like Little Rascals or something.
Yeah,
which is, I assume, how this is produced.
Child labor.
Here's a curtain made out of quilts that you guys sewed together.
Depression era children work on this show. We've managed to keep their bodies preserved.
But you can see the benefits of each kind of constraint and the pros and cons of each kind of constraint.
Yeah.
Sometimes the too much money is not a good thing, and sometimes not enough is. But,
No, that's why, I mean, the space that we have now here in Larchmont Village in Los Angeles is the only thing I have ever been able to compare it to is, well, this is my attempt to kind of have a space like Jack, where I'm Pee Wee and this is the Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And it's such a nice feeling.
Should be too, because I did some research on it and there's a Native American burial ground under here.
Yeah. Oh, we knew that when we got it.
Oh, that's why you got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We went out of our way. I said, find me a Native American burial ground. Yeah. I've got major construction to do. No one's ever gone at it that way.
Yeah, it's
hell of a price.
Interesting.
Yeah. Real deal.
Oh, my God.
Real deal. There's an island that popped in my head because there's this island by where I grew up called Zug Island, if you can believe that's the name of it. And it's this sort of almost like an evil lair, gigantic fire coming out of pipes, rusted, steel, foundry building of some kind. And we always would joke about it. Actually, the White Stripes went. We snuck on Zug Island and took photos in front of a giant coal pile once because we wanted an all-black background. And I was just reading about it, that it was an Indian burial ground for thousands of years before it had been developed in the 1800s or something. And I thought, wow, thousands of years. You ever think about cemeteries and like how there maybe should be more of them? Because of how many people used to live here? And have you ever thought about how many people used to live here?
I haven't thought about any.
And have you ever thought about people that you live with?
Cemeteries is number four on my list of things to talk about.
Okay, yeah.
Too many cemeteries is what I have.
Oh, you have that written down.
Yeah, there are too many.
Oh, I thought there wasn't enough.
I wrote a sketch for SNL once where the prize.
No, but I'm sorry, but to finish that point, where the hell is everybody? There's like two cemeteries in every town. I mean, where did everybody
They're
else
all
go?
On Zug Island.
First of all,
it must be.
What happens is eventually everyone who knows that person is gone.
And then dig that up.
It becomes something else. That's what happens. That's why I refuse to be buried in a traditional grave because I know that 15 years after I'm gone, no one's going to go by that grave.
No.
You're not going, Sona, to see my grave.
Not a week after.
Yeah, not a week after. Yeah.
I'm going
no
out
one's
of my
going
way
there,
to
and then
it.
It's just embarrassing. Yeah. It's embarrassing to have a grave that's all weedy. Yeah. No one's putting fresh flowers down.
And you told me you wanted to be buried next to Jim Morrison in that French cemetery.
Oh, I've arranged for it.
Oh.
But anonymously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
it's have a different name on the gravestone.
Yeah.
Anonymously? What's the point?
Yeah, my name is, there's this little stone that says not Conan O'Brien. It's going to be there.
Parentheses.
And then an arrow going down. yeah. I don't I think about that all the time. This is an obsession of mine.
Yes.
This is crazy that everyone gets their own plot of land when they go. I think it's insane. I think we should all be ground into a powder.
And you buy it, and what are the legalities of it can never ever be sold or moved or dug up, or what are the legalities of you when you buy a plot of land to be buried in? Is that so supposedly forever?
Yes, that's the whole concept. Right? That's what they're selling is forever, but who can promise forever?
No.
It's a scam, I tell you.
Wow.
No.
You're taking on the
I want to be left.
I want a cemetery industry. I think
I want to be left nude in a field where I'll be found by kids.
He
who
wrote
are
to me this morning and said, could you casually bring up cemeteries so that I can finally get to this podcast is really about?
No one knows how this works, but I keep sliding little pieces of paper over to Jack. Yeah. And the last one said cemeteries. And you're great.
Do it. Do it now, by the way. Start talking about something and slide something else to me while we're talking.
We're just
talking.
You know, it's so funny because,
we're filling in the conversation.
Okay. Have a real conversation.
No, but
petunias. gladiolus or petunias. No, I find them both interesting.
Your work with
one can smell better.
The fact
than
that
the other.
You know Bob Dylan and you're connected to that just incredible legacy of work, and that you two have formed a friendship.
Here's the problem, though, Conan. When you are trying to make a corn cob pipe.
Yes,
Sarah is.
And you first you shuck the corn.
Of course.
Okay, no. You got to shuck. All right.
Okay, I love that I moved corn cob over you. This should be the new way that the podcast works, is that I just chat and talk about your incredible, the new work, Fear of the Dawn, you have another album, Entering Heaven Alive. Mm-hmm. You're doing fantastic work.
Right.
Vibrant artist. Hitting on all cylinders.
What's the guy's name? I'm from Monopoly, Mr. Pennybags. Is that his name?
Monocle?
He's got the Mandela effect where people think he has a monocle, but he's never, ever had a monocle.
He doesn't really have a monocle. When I think monocle, I don't know.
That's what came to mind when you talked about my new album.
Wow, there it is. The problem is all these things you slip to them are eventually just going to be compliment me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Compliment my hips. What? Your hips? Oh, God. Conan, your hips seem leaner than they used to. Well, thank you, Jack. I'm just sliding pieces of paper over. Tell me I smell like roses. You smell like roses.
Two things you chose, corn cob and monocle.
Those are the two things. So you're doing a show tonight.
Yes.
What do you have to do this show tonight? Because I want to let you go soon. I want you to get your rest. I know you're in a hyperbaric chamber for up to 3 hours before the show.
Up to 3.5 hours, yeah.
What do you need to do for this show to get into Jack White performance mode?
This is these are some of the backstage requirements. Mm. A conversation with an elderly person.
Incredible.
Bedridden preferred.
You've done it.
Bedridden, yeah. I'm it. I'm your elderly
person. Oh, okay,
person.
So I can cross that one out.
Thanks, Gorley.
You bet, buddy. I mean, granddad.
You give me the next one. What would you have for my, let's say, what you would hope that you would see on my rider?
I would like you have to eat a huge, heavy meal. Like a lot of rich, rich meat, a lot of beans, a lot of sweet molasses beans, and you kind of have to eat all of it, and you have a big bib on, and it gets all stained with like the beans and stuff.
A Monte Cristo.
And then you have to go, like a deep fried sandwich.
And didn't realize I was wearing the shirt I wanted to wear on stage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then you have to go out and give a high voltage performance. And the fun is everyone in the audience knows. They're told beforehand, ladies and gentlemen, he's just had 6 pounds of sugary, sweet molasses beans, and he's had 8 pounds of short rib, and he's had 14 pounds of corn.
Did you say you were going to come to tomorrow's show? Is that what you said?
Okay, and I'm going to jump up on stage with a ukulele.
Please. I don't know when this is going to be. Is this?
I never know. No one lets me know.
It's long from now.
It's not a few weeks.
It's not
airing.
We're not airing live. It's not live.
No.
You could give me a list of 3 things that I have to mention on stage tomorrow.
Oh, wow. I'll do that.
That kind of pandering.
That kind of pandering.
July 4th.
We're going to call it reverse pandering. Reverse pandering.
I love that. I love the idea that you have to work this crap in.
Yeah, that's great.
And you have to work it into song lyrics.
Well, just hand me the paper before I go out and. I'll tape it to my amplifier.
What's that?
Say it.
Maybe he can tell you later. Okay. This is what I gave him. If it works out.
Yeah.
Maybe I can't. Yeah, maybe I won't be able to work it out. Too,
else you just have to, at some point in the night, you have to reference Baron von Hindenburg.
Okay.
But in a way that feels natural.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't want to know until right before I go on stage.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you're like, yeah, I'll figure it out. But it's going to be you just sweating and being like, man.
It's hard to work in Baron von Hindenburg.
Yeah. It's great to be here in Cleveland. I'm actually from Akron. Sir, please, sit down. I flew in. Before I let you go, I have to say that there are many things that I adore about you, but one is your guitar playing. I think it's such a hard instrument to make yourself identifiable on because there are so many guitarists in the world. I always know it's you playing. No matter what effect you've done, I always know it's you.
You've got that
very cool sort of staccato style that you play that just always speaks to me. Like, I know exactly who this is.
Wow. It's wild because I grew up being a drummer I avoided the guitar because I thought everybody plays guitar. And just like you said, it'd be so hard to be unique. And I think that kind of turned me off when I first sort of went to New York and LA when I was a teenager. I thought, oh, wow, this is like, it doesn't feel special. It feels like everybody's doing what you're doing.
Right.
Or there's 7,000, you're a drummer, big deal. There's 7,000 drummers here, you know, or whatever. So I thought, well, I should avoid that as much as possible. But then I realized it was kind of the only way to really, really connect all the pieces together and present it to other human beings in a way. I mean, if you do poetry, you will find a certain amount of people who will listen and pay attention and get something from it. But you'll find a lot more if you put that to a melody, you know. And if you're a drummer, you could connect to some people, but not really unless you sing something along with it or play, you know. So really the way to sort of connect with others with art, I mean, and music is you have to sort of play that instrument, whether you like it or not. I think guitar or piano.
Yeah.
And so I sort of picked guitar from kind of basically just teaching myself over the years when I was a kid to slightly how to play it. You know, I think maybe that has something to do with it. If you're finding it unique when you hear it, it's probably because of my disbelief that I could be unique with it,
right.
And sort of giving up on that. You know, almost like, oh, whatever, you know, maybe this will just get tossed on the pile with all the other guitar players. So I might as well not even try to be as good as them or try to be as interesting as what they're doing. I'll just use it as my form of expression. And really, I want to get to the story and the whole point of the song is what I'm trying to get at. This is just kind of a MacGuffin. So maybe that has something to do with it being. I still don't know if I agree with you that it is that unique. But if you're seeing that, maybe it has something to do with those kind of ideas.
Well, I do think it's the way you came at it is very different. And I'm not the only person that says this, but you're playing when you take a solo and eating your rhythm parts. It's very. I just know it's you, and I think so many people. what they really want to do is have a Les Paul and be able to play very smoothly and get this kind of, they want to sound like their heroes. And I always think it's our failure to be our heroes. I mean, the people I grew up idolizing.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I was just saying. You encompassed it that way.
Yeah, we'll edit it. Great. So you said it. when I hear you, I don't hear a guy who was working necessarily on, I want to sound just like Jimmy Page, or I want to sound just like this person or that person and have this really smooth, great, you figured it out.
You hear like a guy miserably failing is what you're saying to me.
Yeah.
You're listening to the sound of failure.
Your solo.
In real time.
Yes. This is it. We cracked it. You fail consistently. And I wanted to, by the way, why don't we get more people coming in to be interviewed
this
by me?
This is the last one we had left. And so now we're done.
Yeah, we've alienated everyone now. This is what I say to everyone here. It's your failure over and over again, perpetual failure, that's brought you to me.
Hey, why is your guitar, why is it engraved Connie Stevens?
Because you know what it costs to have your own name put in there?
It's too many letters.
Yeah. I'm at the Connie. Conan's at the Connie Stevens estate sale again. Listen, I want to let you go. I want you to have a great day. Rest up. I'm going to come
see you
tomorrow. I'm just, it's a joy to know you. It's a joy to know you.
Oh man, likewise, seriously, Conan. Seriously. It really is. It's great. I was thinking earlier when you said that, you know, I think that you were the first well-known person or celebrity that I ever saw in public and went up and said hello to. I don't know if you ever
That's right. It was a bowling alley in Detroit and I was there shooting a remote. And afterwards, the writer Tommy Blacha and I went to this bowling alley and I was bowling and we were in a Detroit bowling alley that had like a bar next to it. And the next thing I know, these like cool young kids, it was you.
Yeah.
Was Meg there?
Yeah, Meg was in the next room. A bunch of the garage rockers were there.
Yeah.
About a week, I kind of kept kicking myself like, wow, I don't know why I did it. Why did I go up to him while he was sitting at a dinner table and said hi to him? I mean, I shouldn't have done that.
But it was so nice because we got along, we hung out, we chatted, and then cut to like, I want to say 2 years later, I see that you and Meg are playing SNL, and I go up, and I don't remember you from the bowling alley.
Sure, of course.
Because you were a kid.
Yeah.
And I remember telling you, it's your failure.
No, oh, no. That will be
your success.
I said,
you're a failure, and that's going to make you a success. And you were really bummed. No. But I came up to you at SNL, and I watched you guys rehearse.
Yeah.
And then you came over and you went, it's good to see you again. And I was like, again? I've not met Jack White before. And you went, yeah, we met in Detroit. So you reminded me that we had met each other. And
you were wearing a monocle, I think.
I was wearing a monocle.
And a corn cob pipe.
And very good. This is all very good. No, but it was one of the nice.
You just don't keep bringing up monocle over. You weren't saying bring this up as many times as you possibly can. That wasn't the challenge.
It says monocle times seven.
Oh, yeah, you do an X.
Monocle to the eighth power. Well, anyway, monocle, corn cob monocle. I'm going to have a corn cob monocle made for you and I'll send it to your wacky house of horrors in Nashville. Jack, that was a lovely accident that we met each other those years ago.
Really was,
And we've kept it going. Mm-hmm. And then you were kind enough when we came up with this podcast. There was one song I wanted. Mm-hmm. We were going to be friends. And you were like, sure. An incredible price we had to pay every time. you're living solely off those royalties now. You haven't recorded anything since.
We haven't made a dime on this show yet.
We're in the hole. We lose $600,000 a month on this show.
But
I insisted on that song.
Yeah.
Anyway, have a great show. Knock 'em dead.
Thank you.
And Congrats on being you. You're very good at being you. Keep doing that.
Thank you. You as well, man. And love what you're doing and always have. And we always say, you know, all of our friends, like you're the first name that comes up, you know, when we think of this is what we, you know, when it was late night TV, oh, that's the show we want to do. And this is the way it should be done. And your sense of humor has got such a different take on it than all that sort of plastic stuff that was out there, especially all those years. So,
yeah.
You know,
well, thank you. I just said, yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean that. Yeah. I meant like, that's, I got uncomfortable.
But it was
for
a long, yeah. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yep. I always was better than everyone else.
Someone finally gets me.
It's true, though.
Well, you heard it here. Conan, better than everyone. Yeah. Hey, Jack, thank you so much.
Thank you, Conan. Appreciate it.
You know, on the Jeff Goldblum episode recently, and today's episode, we discussed how there were a number of rejected theme songs for James Bond movies.
Mm. Yes, and this is something that I guess is one of your orgasmic pleasures in life, is talking about James Bond movies. It's something that you know a lot about. Yeah. I'm not putting you down.
No,
in
and
any
I
way.
Didn't even bring this up.
No, and crazily, it came up with Jeff Goldblum and then came up again with Jack White, the idea that Johnny Cash apparently wanted to write and sing a Bond theme and submitted it, and it was rejected.
Or just ignored, even more likely. I'm not sure.
Ignoring a submission is a rejection,
that's right,
in my opinion. But the idea being, that's fascinating that, you know, you think of, Johnny Cash was a genius and such a seminal figure, and I adore Johnny Cash. The idea that he would say, he would submit a song, a James Bond theme, and it would be, you know, thanks a lot, pal. Just move along. Move along. Thanks for your time. Get that jalopy out of here. That amazes me.
So there's a rich history of famous musicians submitting and or being even requested to submit for Bond songs that have not been used. And I thought I'd put it together into a quiz.
Okay.
And you guys, I will read you the name and the year of the movie and four musicians or bands, and you have to guess which one is the one that actually had a song. And then you can hear these songs online too.
Not the real one.
Not the real one that was in the movie, but there is a musician or band that did a real song and it was rejected. So these are rejected.
How many of these happened when I was alive?
One.
Oh, fuck you.
No, I'm sorry. Three. What year were you born?
82.
Three.
Okay.
But these are not things that either of you, no one would know these things.
He knows, he's like, oh, that band was like big in that time.
I've structured the answers so that's.
Yeah, this, okay. Yeah, just this relax.
I'm thinking of you, Sona.
There's no stakes here, Sona. Yeah.
No, there just are. Relax. There are always stakes.
But listen,
there are always stakes.
So I'm curious.
Yeah.
I just want to be very clear because I think, and to be fair, and the listeners will agree, you didn't set this up that clearly. These are actual submissions that were rejected.
Yes.
Got it.
And I'm doing this for the show and for you guys. I don't give a damn about any of this stuff. I'm not wearing a t-shirt right now with a James Bond reference on it. It's just like, this is a service. I don't care. I don't even like James Bond.
I love James Bond. Don't you have a podcast about James Bond? No.
Didn't you over COVID build a James Bond Aston Martin out of Legos?
I thought you were heading for a joke and I actually did.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But didn't you? You did.
Wait, you did?
I did.
Oh.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Well, let's do the quiz.
He also built, he built Sean Connery out of Legos. A full-size, 6'1" Sean Connery out of Legos.
Easier than you think.
Yeah. It was, he made it, it was over 600,000 Legos.
Oh, but you don't like James Bond.
Don't even know who he is. All right. Okay, the first.
Wait, again, just to ring in, because he never gets this.
All we
right,
do is recap.
Okay. Is when
one
it's
more
time.
Let me understand. These are microphones,
us,
and we're in a.
Excuse me. When it's time for us to answer, we say our name and then we answer.
Yes,
because he
correct.
Never does that.
No, and
I just want to make sure.
He won't be acknowledged if he doesn't. So
yes,
you have to say your name. And then if you answer incorrectly, you're locked out. The other person gets to answer.
Yes. Okay.
Let's go, because this is riveting.
Okay.
You're so angry. You're like building it down just in case I win. You want to act like you don't care.
I think this is boring. I didn't even want to do this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You're not a big, huge James Bond fan.
All right.
You built a Timothy Dalton that's 600 feet high. Out of macaroons during COVID. Is that true or not true?
I put a Timothy Dalton skin of macaroons on the Seattle Space Needle.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. The year is 2015.
Got it.
The
remember
film
it very well.
Is Spectre.
Spectre. Ooh. Got it.
Okay. Now I'm going to read four musicians or bands. Mm-hmm. Ready?
What are you writing down?
Just chill, okay. Chum.
Ready? Mm. Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Sheeran.
Mm-hmm.
Arcade Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Radiohead.
Sona. Arcade Fire.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect. Conan?
I'm going to say it's not Sir Paul, because Sir Paul did Live and Let Die.
And I can't think. Mind, Shirley Bassey did three.
Yeah, but I know, but I just don't believe it was Paul McCartney because I don't picture anyone saying to Paul McCartney, thanks, pal, but take a walk.
Well, and I'm not a James Bond fan, but when he submitted Live and Let Die, the producer, Harry Saltzman, said, that sounds great. Who are we going to get to sing it?
Are you guys going to have like a longer conversation before he answers?
Conan, what's your answer?
Ed Sheeran.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect.
Damn. Who was it?
It's Radiohead.
Radiohead submitted. God. Radiohead submitted a song,
and you can hear it online. Yeah,
and they said we're good. We don't need it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think it's better than the.
What did they?
Sam Smith. And I like Sam Smith otherwise, but this.
I think I remember his.
Yeah, writings on the wall. Yeah. Okay, the year is 1981.
This is me thinking about you and I. We both have a slight musical bent.
Yeah.
Gourley, we should submit a James Bond song and try and I'd be happy to sing it.
Rejected.
Thank you. No, but just
oh yes.
But we just need to have
rejected.
The title. We have to have the title.
Yeah,
have to have the title of the of what the. Do you know what the next Bond film's going to be?
No one does. They don't even have the.
But
Bond.
They don't have a title yet.
No, so we can make sky's
oh, they don't even
the
have
limit.
The Bond.
No, sky's the limit.
Sky's the limit is a great title.
Oh my God.
Sky's the limit.
Already rejected.
Sky's the limit.
No one wants.
Wherever you go.
Can't you
more.
Go beyond the sky? Is
ooh, oh,
the limit.
Ooh, we got to work on this.
The year is 2025.
2025.
The musicians are Conan O'Brien and Matt Gourley.
Yep.
Okay, no.
The Both year, of us playing the zither.
The year is 1981.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The movie, For Your Eyes Only. We're in the Roger Moore era.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
The four musicians,
mm-hmm.
Pete Townsend,
mm-hmm.
Pet Shop Boys.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Bush or Blondie?
Sona.
Yes.
I'm going to say Kate Bush.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect.
Yeah, I love this game where she just blurts out the wrong thing right away. I like to take a little time before I say the wrong thing.
That's how quizzes work. You don't have a discussion with whoever is conducting
this
the
is
quiz. And then just, you know, be like, well, it can't be Paul McCartney. And he's talking about Shirley Bassey. Like, what is this? This isn't fair. You have to answer.
Whoa.
I hate that.
He just like Crocodile
Dundee'd
you.
So much. Oh, nothing fills me with more rage.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
We edit it up so it'll come out faster. Okay, that's the beauty of it.
No, we're going to let people know.
I'm going with Blondie.
That's correct.
Yes.
And
it's, I think, better than the Sheena Easton one. I love Blondie. This song's cracking.
Yeah. What is the song?
It's called For Your Eyes Only.
Does she do it like Blondie? For Your Eyes Only.
No, it's a little more slow.
For Your Eyes Only and I'm feeling blue.
It's, oh, I love that song.
Which, okay.
Heart of Glass.
Yeah, Heart of Glass.
Yeah. Okay, the year, 1995.
Okay.
The film, Goldeneye. Mm. It's Pierce Brosnan's first time as James Bond.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Ace of Base.
Mm-hmm.
Depeche Mode.
Mm-hmm.
Oasis or Blur?
Sona. I am just guessing. All of these are just guesses. Oasis.
Sorry, that's incorrect.
Come on.
I'll go with the correct answer, which is Depeche Mode.
I'm sorry, no.
Damn it! I wanted to come in with a lot of authority.
You really know what?
If I'm going to be wrong, I want to go in. When I used to play basketball with my brothers, my favorite thing to do was be way outside and say, nothing but net! And then hurl up a giant brick. It's my favorite thing to do. You know?
Oh my
Put
God.
It up. It's a three. And then hurl the shittiest shot anyone's ever seen. And it would smash a neighbor's window.
I'm going to throw a curveball at you guys.
No, who was it?
I'm going to throw a curveball at you. Goldeneye, 1995. Is it Ace of Base or Blur?
I'm going to...
Ace of Me.
Ring in.
I'm going to say
this
Conan.
This is a quiz, yes.
I just think it's too early for Blur. It feels too early to me. That's why Ace of Base is crazy, though. That's crazy.
Is that your answer?
No, I think I'm going to have to say Ace of Base.
He wants to see if you're giving
I'll
him
say
any
Ace
reactions.
Of Base.
I'm not giving anything.
No, I'll say Ace of Base.
Okay, so you rang in.
Yeah, I'll say Ace of Base.
The correct answer is Ace of Base.
Yeah.
And you can hear this song, but they changed the title and called it The Juvenile instead of The Goldeneye.
You're not allowed, if you're an artist, to change the title of the James Bond movie.
Well, no.
You
After
can't,
it
like,
was rejected, they wanted to put it out as a song.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see. I was thinking of, someone like Cher saying, I want to record the song for the new James Bond movie. And they're like, okay, Cher, cool. And he's like, yeah. Well, anyway, the title of it is, A Bullet for the Brain. And she's like, no. No, that's not the movie title anymore.
Cher, she can do that.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's all about, you know.
She can do that, though. She's Cher.
No, whatever.
Was Cher ever rejected?
Not that I know of.
I hope not.
I mean, probably never in life. Cher should never be rejected.
Never.
Look, already this segment has gone on longer than I would have ever wanted to talk about James Bond.
Right.
So what we're going to do is we're going to roll this over into a two-part.
You have taken your own personal obsession and hijacked, use it to hijack a very popular podcast, and you've taken it down this cuckoo cul-de-sac where only you want to hang.
There's never been a popular podcast that used the term cuckoo cul-de-sac.
Well, next summer, instead of Chill Chums, it should be Welcome to the Cuckoo Cul-de-Sac.
I like
with
it.
Conan and his Quasies, all with K's.
Write that down.
Welcome to the Cuckoo Cul-de-Sac with Conan and his Quasies.
All right, we'll see you next episode.
If you dare.
Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, with Conan O'Brien, Sona Movsesian, and Matt Gourley. Produced by me, Matt Gourley. Executive produced by Adam Sachs, Joanna Solitaroff, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Theme song by The White Stripes. Incidental music by Jimmy Vivino. Take it away, Jimmy. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, and our associate talent producer is Jennifer Samples. Engineering by Will Beckton. Additional production support by Mars Melnick. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, and Britt Kahn. You can rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for Conan? Call the Team Coco hotline at 323-451-2821 and leave a message. It, too, could be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.